So welcome to the continuation of Theology, the Future of Biblical Interpretation in Relation to the Science Faith Dialogue. And first up, we have John Hilber, Cosmological and Biblical Accommodation, Insights from Relevance Theory. Over to you.
The handout is not essential for what I have to say, but it'll be useful for you, I think. In the long run, I teach Old Testament studies at McMaster Divinity College here in Hamilton, and along with Old Testament, I dabble in hermeneutics and linguistics a little bit, and that's what brings us to this topic. This came out of research that I did when I was a fellow at the Creation Project. Maybe some of you have heard of that. That was conducted at the Henry Center of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School back a few years ago when I was there. I did my undergrad in geology and then went off into biblical studies and theology and pastored for first half of my career and then went on for doctoral studies. And so my entire life, I've walked in this tension between the biblical language and what I believe my science was telling me. And this is a result of a few years of trying to think this bit through. So let me just talk for 2 minutes, maybe about what relevance theory is. It's very intuitive. All of you operate with relevance theory every day in every communication situation that you are in. And so what I'm going to do is, after a brief introduction of it, I'm going to illustrate it, and you will catch on intuitively as to what I'm talking about. And then I will apply it with respect to some of the language in the Bible that has to do with cosmology. So relevance theory is just a communication model that explains how we as listeners or readers make sense of what we're hearing or what we are reading. What explains the interpretations that we come to as an audience? Now, a good number of years ago, I was leaving chapel with another colleague, and chapel at our school got out right before lunch, and I did this. I held up an apple, and I said, "I'm going to keep the doctor away." What did I just tell my colleague? "I'm going to eat an apple." And at the speed of light, his brain intuitively put together the time of day, something in the physical environment that I made ostensive, that I made fairly evident as I lifted it. He put that together. He shared with me in common a typical proverb in our culture: an apple a day keeps the doctor away. And so he had to supply the first half of it. And putting all those things together, he inferred that I was going to eat an apple for lunch. And furthermore, we as a faculty had just had a conversation the day before in a faculty meeting about how important backgrounds are, more or less, in the task of biblical interpretation. And we happen to be on two different sides of the argument. I'm a comparativist or a contextualist. I work a lot with biblical backgrounds and use that for interpretation. And he's more of a minimalist, where he thinks the text is self-referential sufficient on its own. And so we're friends. He smiled and chuckled a little bit because he understood that I wasn't just giving him trivial information about what I was eating for lunch. I was actually trying to score another point with my friend about how important context is to understanding human communication. So relevance theory is an inferential model. We do not understand language by pulling out a dictionary and looking words up and a grammar and putting the syntax together, and that's all we need. We actually infer from our context, and the context, as you can see in the handout, is everything and anything that is accessible to the mind of the audience. So that in a nutshell is relevance theory, and what relevance theory does is it works with optimal communication. The speaker wants to maximize the benefit. The listener wants to maximize the benefit. The speaker wants to be most efficient and economical to deliver to satisfy the expectations of the audience. And the two work together in an agreement for optimal communication that is inferential in nature based upon the cognitive environment, the context around them as they speak and in their memories and in what they share. All right, so what's accommodation? Accommodation goes clear back to the ancient church. It is simply, to use the analogy that the ancients used, it's a metaphor based upon pedagogy that the speaker uses what is understood in the environment that is known by the recipient to help to communicate. The ancient church used the word condescension. As God speaks to us as human beings, he has to come down to our level. Calvin used the word baby talk, or the phrase baby talk in expressing this. So I'm just using accommodation in the very broad sense of the word that the entire church has agreed to from day one, pretty much. One of the contributions of relevance theory that will be the focus of what I have to share today is the distinction that they draw between what is merely implicit in the cognitive environment and what is actually implicated, that is brought into the communication act from the environment. There are lots of assumptions that are implicit in the environments in which we live that aren't necessarily part of what we're trying to communicate with each other until we give some words that give guidance to the listener to implicate those elements of the environment that are important to draw upon for inferential processing. Let's just take the example. We're walking in a field on a hot day, sun's bearing down on us. I say, there's a tree. You might instinctively put together, oh, yeah, let's get some shade. You know, we need a break from this oppressive heat. Change contexts. Now we're in the desert, our water skins are getting empty, and I say, there's a tree, a palm tree, right, you know, over the next hill there. Ah, where there's a tree, there's an oasis, and there is water. We want to get a further view into the distance. Trees have height, we can climb it. If we happen to live in the world of Narnia, then we have different assumptions, and there are dryads that live as parts of trees. And so if I said, you know, there's a tree, we're going to go talk to a dryad, perhaps. Now, that's a false assumption in our real world communication setting. And you can see then how by merely changing context, I change which assumptions we all share about trees. I change which assumptions are being implicated in the act of communication. I might be drawing upon the assumption about shade, about water, about height, or if we're living in the world of Narnia, I might be drawing on the assumption about dryads living in trees. So that's the difference between what's implicit, anything that's accessible in our encyclopedic entries of our minds, what is implicit, and what am I actually implicating as I'm trying to communicate with you? That's the crucial issue that relevance theory brings to the fore as we can think through a little more carefully what we mean by this phrase accommodation. All right, let's look first at some examples that are not cosmological. They're not going to be contested. You go into the grocery store. Where do you look for tomatoes? You go to where the lettuce is and the celery, the other vegetables, right? Are you working off of the assumption that a tomato is a vegetable? I thought tomatoes were vegetables until not many years ago, actually, when it in fact is actually a fruit. Well, are we going to go storm to the grocery produce manager and say, "You stinking liar! Why are you putting tomatoes with the vegetables? Don't you know that tomatoes are fruits?" No, we're not, because the produce manager is appealing to a context of culinary interest. And so he's organized the tomatoes in a way that makes, you know, sense for what our expectations of relevance are in that particular context. Now, if we happen to go on a field trip at an ASA meeting and we go into a botanical museum and you find tomatoes, it's, you know, put in the display with the other vegetables, you might go to the curator of the museum. Don't you know that I have a PhD in botany and you just really are wrong here. Yeah, change the context and things differ in terms of what our expectations are about relevance. I don't know what LSEP is, but that's snuck in there somehow. Okay, let's look at a biblical illustration that is not cosmological. And this is, again, one I like to pick, one that's not going to be contested or problematic. We have verses encouraging animal sacrifice. And there's a set of assumptions in the ancient world about animal sacrifice. Now, some of them are false assumptions, that you actually can bribe the deities with your sacrifice. There's an assumption that offerings are necessary to feed the gods. In fact, in the classic work on Mesopotamian civilization, Oppenheim has the phrase, the care and feeding of the gods, one big chapter, because the assumption is so, you know, prevalent. Go to Egypt, same assumptions, that offerings actually take care of the deified deceased. Go to the Anatolia, same assumptions. Go to Israel. Well, if they're Orthodox, they would not share those assumptions. That would be a false assumption to an Orthodox Israelite. But still, rather than the Lord needing food, the Lord is pleased when his children bring something that costs them, was sacrificial to bring him as an expression or token of their love. So that is a fair and true assumption. Now, there's another assumption that animal horns that are, you know, part of the sacrificial process, animal horns are dangerous. You can poke yourself. Yeah, but that's not being implicated in Leviticus chapter 1. That's not a relevant, although true, assumption from the context. It's just not brought into the communication situation of Leviticus chapter 1. Now, because of the fact that some Israelites are going to share the wrong assumption, God actually corrects that. Psalm 50 does that for us, and I'm sure that the priests in ancient Israel, if they were doing their job, and if the parents were raising their children, they would teach them correctly that the Lord God is the creator of the ends of the earth, owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, and he doesn't need our offerings at all. But for those who might get led astray, they need a little bit more linguistic code to make clear the correct assumptions to use in the instruction. All right, let's move on to cosmology. The sun rising, there are false assumptions. There are true assumptions about that. Does the sun actually move around a geocentric Earth? False assumption. It was an assumption that I'm convinced that all ancient people, you know, as far as we know, pre circa, 500 in Greek natural philosophy, thereabouts, they thought that the sun revolved around a fixed Earth. The truth is that the Earth rotates on an axis. Now, I know we can quibble about, is there ever such a thing as an absolute reference point in space? You know, I don't want to go there. But there are other assumptions. When the sun rises, it's morning. The sun also, when it comes up, if you get exposed, it can bring harm to you. And if you look up those biblical texts, the ones in Genesis there, they use the sun rising as a chronological marker in in the context of the narrative to be a signal and to communicate to the reader an orientation to the time of day. Now, if you're reading the book of Jonah, the sun's coming up in Jonah chapter 4, and you're going, uh-oh, you know, Jonah's out on the east side of the city, and it's the desert, and he's going to get scorched. So what assumptions are relevant that are implicated by the speaker or writer in the communication situation change based on context? Let's go to one, the greater and lesser lights from Genesis chapter 1. This goes back to Augustine, Calvin, Luther. They all spoke about this particular example for the purposes of accommodation. And they understood that there was, an issue about the relative size versus the absolute size of astronomical objects. But for the ancients, they didn't understand that. So for the ancients, they thought that there was an absolute difference in size between these objects. Now, the false assumption of the size absolutely is not being implicated in Genesis chapter 1. And so it's not a problem for the truthfulness of the text. And Augustine and Calvin and Luther were very clear about that. They understood that it's an issue of what's conspicuous. It's an issue of what is therefore an appropriate marker. And therefore, if you're an agrarian living in a culture that is driven by the temple calendar, so that religious seasons are set, then those are the relevant assumptions that are at play in operation in the text as an ancient Israelite would read the text, not questions about the relative versus absolute size of these astronomical objects. All right, for the last example I want to use, it's the hardest one that I know in the Old Testament, probably in the whole Bible. This is the toughest example where the language of the text seems to encourage the entertainment of a false assumption. Now, relevance theory has this concept of weaker and stronger implicatures. You know, how strongly or weakly does the speaker or author rely upon the context to bring that information as an assumption in for inferential reasoning for the listener, reader, to make sense of the text? And in this particular case, it seems like the language of Genesis 1 really does put in the forefront this notion of a body of water that exists above this interface called the firmament. Now, there are good scholars, friends of mine, and they might be right, that think this is not a problem. They would say that the water above the firmament is just a metaphorical way of speaking or an approximate way of speaking of clouds and rain. And if they're correct, then there's not a problem here, and I'm fretting over nothing. And they might be right about that. I'm not convinced yet that that's the case. Based upon Egyptian, Mesopotamian cosmic geography, it's pretty clear that they assumed a body of water above the firmament, and I suspect Israel shared the same assumption about cosmic geography. So I'm the kind of person, I like to make the case, as hard against myself as I can in order to try to deal with it. And so I'm trying to deal with this example. And in this particular case, we have some false assumptions. Is Marduk the source of rain? If you read the Mesopotamian creation account of Enuma Elish, Marduk is the one who takes the cosmic ocean dragon chaos monster, splits her in half, puts half her waters above, half her waters below, takes her skin to make a firmament to keep the waters above from falling down. And he brings water out of this firmament and makes clouds from which they get rain. Ancients knew they got rain from clouds. There's no question about that. They probably understood something about evaporation. They can see moisture coming out of the ground. They knew, read 1 Kings 18, Elijah's looking on the horizon, he sees a cloud forming, he knows the rain's coming. So they weren't stupid. They had some sense about things. And I suspect that they shared the true assumption that the sky contains condensed water vapor that makes clouds and can rain. But I think they also had this idea about a cosmic ocean that was inseparably connected with this business of cosmogony. That's the origins of the cosmos. How did the cosmos develop and evolve into the universe that they inhabit? And that was intertwined inseparably with the idea of theogony, that is the origins of the gods as well, who manifest themselves in these physical cosmic objects, so that the sun is a manifestation of Shamash, the sun god, as one example. So they had this this false theological integration that was pretty much pantheistic. And that idea was pervasive across the ancient Near East. And it's a false assumption that I think that Moses, I suspect Moses wrote Genesis 1. I'm still old school in that. And I came back to that actually by studying Egyptian cosmology and seeing how much Genesis 1 plays off against the Egyptian cosmology over against Mesopotamian. And I'm thinking, yeah, this is appealing to what's relevant to Israelites who have just spent 400 years in Egypt. And that's the environment in which they lived. So I'm thinking that Genesis is not trying to teach us that this is really the structure of the universe, but it's assuming for the sake of argument something that everybody in the ancient Near East assumed is true. And it's doing it for the purpose of presenting a counter narrative. Some like to call it a polemic. There might be technical distinctions between a polemic and a counter narrative that I frankly think are nicely nuanced. I like those differences. It depends on how explicit the object is named that's being attacked. In Genesis, I'm not sure it's that explicit. So I prefer to call it a counter narrative. And so I think that the author is using a false assumption weakly implicated for the sake of argument. And so instead, Genesis is offering a counter narrative to ancient Near Eastern creation accounts and beliefs by weakly implicating something for the sake of argument. That's how I deal with what I think is the strongest case or the most problematic case of what appears to be false assumptions expressed in the linguistic code of the Old Testament. So in summary, communication is inferential. One of the applications of relevance theory that if you want to ask me about it, literal interpretation is not, repeat that, literal interpretation is not the default in any human communication. That's something that I was taught in my first year of seminary. This is wrong. The text is to be interpreted literally until the literal sense makes no sense, unless the literal sense. That's just wrong linguistically. And I've talked to a lot of linguists about that, and they all agree, relevance theorists or not. But inferential processing is the way that it works, and the linguistic code, the words used, help the reader or listener access assumptions in the context from which they infer meaning. So the author guides to appropriate implications. If there are misinterpretations of a text, it typically arises from assumptions that are implicit and brought into the text that shouldn't be, or they are assumptions that the modern reader has that they bring to the text that shouldn't be brought either. So you can be bringing, either way, from both directions, you can be bringing things into the text, and it leads to wrong interpretation. Assumptions that are weakly related to the informative intention are the responsibility of us, the reader, not the author, either human or divine. So in the handout, there's a bibliography of, take you right to some of the helpful things that you would find useful. I wish I had had my hands on Billy Clark's work when I did my research I have a book out on cosmology that's listed in there as well in relevance theory. But I think Billy Clark's work is most extensive. Gene Green is a very, very short, brief introduction that's excellent as well. Wilson and Sperber are tough going, but that's the horse's mouth. All right, so thank you.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you. I apologize if I missed this at the beginning of your talk, but the use of the term water in verses 6 and 7, is that the same as in verse 2 of Genesis chapter 1?
Yes, mayim, waters.
Yeah, it's the same thing?
Yeah.
Okay. I just wondered.
Yes, it's just the same Hebrew word, and it's...
I'm just wondering if in verse 2 it could have a more generic significance, because God couldn't give them a full cosmological explanation of what was going on, so we used the word water instead.
Is Genesis 1:2 using the word waters in a more sort of generic way that shouldn't be problematic for us? That's my friends who think it's just rain or whatever, they're not concerned that it's this technical waters above becomes this cosmic ocean kind of thing. And so I think that's a good question, and it's the kind of question that we need to be asking of the text. It's the same Hebrew word, but you have to ask, what is it trying to implicate? What assumptions about that body or that object are being implicated in the meaning of the text at that point?